loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, the anti-Russia witch hunt has taken another odious turn. Former officials of the Department of Homeland Security under the Obama administration are making a cottage industry by attacking alternative media, including our show, Loud and Clear, and specifically our segment called Criminal Injustice, where we talk every Thursday about the injustices carried out in the courts, in the prisons, and by police. We're going to talk about this attack on alternative media and on our show. And then in our second half hour, it's our weekly segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where we look at the state of education across the country. Today, Dr. Monique Rideau-Smith is sitting in for Bill, and we'll talk with her about the historic Chicago charter school strike that just successfully finished yesterday. Next, British Prime Minister Theresa May called off tomorrow's critical vote on her Brexit deal so she can go back to Brussels and ask for changes in it. British political observers say that the deal would have been easily defeated and would have plunged the British political scene into chaos. Then, in a nationally televised address this afternoon, French President Emmanuel Macron said that he would speed up tax relief for struggling workers and scrap a tax hike for retirees. Macron had earlier promised to raise the minimum wage and to abolish taxes on overtime pay. All of these promises were made to contain 4 weeks of demonstrations against his policies that have devolved into nationwide rioting. And then Venezuelans held municipal elections on Sunday to elect some 2,500 local councilors. Turnout was relatively low, with opposition parties boycotting the polls, but debate is raging as Venezuela attempts to overcome its economic crisis and efforts to isolate it on the world stage. And finally, today is the 70th anniversary of the adoption by the United Nations of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The document gives to all humans basic human rights, including the right to work for equal pay, the right to not be enslaved, the right to health care, the right to amnesty in other countries, and more. But even in the richest economies, like the United States, people are still being denied these fundamental rights. And in other headlines, Maria Butina, a student and gun activist from Russia, filed documents today indicating that she will plead guilty to charges of conspiracy and failing to register as a foreign agent. She was arrested in July and has been held in detention without bail for 5 months since then. The post-midterm staff shakeup in the Trump administration continued to take shape in recent days. Chief of Staff John Kelly's departure was confirmed. However, it remains unclear who his replacement will be. Nick Ayers, former Chief of Staff to Vice President Mike Pence, was widely considered to be the favorite, but Ayers took himself out of consideration over the weekend. Renowned historian and author William Bloom died yesterday at the age of 85. Bloom was a prominent critic of U.S. war and intervention around the world, working tirelessly to expose the terrible consequences of U.S. foreign policy. His books included Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II, and Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower. Prosecutors filed additional documents late last week on the government's case against former lawyer for President Trump, Michael Cohen. They asked for a sentence of 42 months in prison, lower than the guidelines of 51 to 63 months. The documents also indicated that the investigation would be moving on to Trump's personal business dealings and would be focused less on attempting to find collusion with Russia. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Every Thursday, Loud and Clear helps expose the injustices carried out by America's courts, prisons, and police departments. Our regular segment is called Criminal Injustice, and it recently caught the attention of professional Russia bashers, including a former Undersecretary of Homeland Security, who claims that this specific segment of our show, of Loud and Clear, is part of a dastardly foreign plot to undermine confidence in the oh-so-wonderful institutions of the U.S. criminal justice system. We're joined by our two guests in that weekly segment. Kevin Gostala is a writer for Shadowproof.com and the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul is also the editor of Prison Legal News and the Criminal Legal News magazines. They both regularly join us every Thursday for our regular segment called Criminal Injustice. Kevin and Paul, welcome back.
Thank you. Hi, thanks for having us on the show.
John, were you surprised?
No.
I was a little, I'm not shocked. I was a little surprised when I opened the Washington Post and it said, the cybersecurity 202, Russia is trying to undermine Americans' confidence in the justice system, security experts warn. And they were talking about us.
Yeah, literally, they were talking about us. You know that phrase, shocked but not surprised?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was this for me. I was shocked but not surprised. I was more angry than anything else because the bottom line of this criticism is if you criticize any aspect of the government, and their specific criticism of us is that we criticize the criminal justice system, that you are weakening the country. That we, when we have our show, Criminal Injustice, when we have that segment every Thursday with Kevin and Paul, that we are weakening democracy by criticizing injustice. I mean, that makes me angry, because what weakens democracy is stupid reports from ill-informed people like this who seek to shut down debate. That's what weakens democracy.
Well, or they could say that from their perspective, that anything that threatens the stranglehold of the police state over every aspect of our lives weakens, if not democracy, the oligarchy's control over our lives and political power. I mean, I'd say at the end of the day, you know, political power rests on the military and the police.
Here's from the Washington Post. A group of cybersecurity, national security, and legal experts is warning that Russia's efforts to weaken America's democratic institutions aren't limited to elections, but also extend to the U.S. justice system. Kevin Gostala, I mean, wow, you're undermining American democracy by every week coming on. You probably do this every day of your life. You just keep telling the truth about the criminal justice system in America. How'd you feel?
Yeah, I'm honored. I suppose I should feel honored and praised because it means that we're being noticed. But also, you know, I mean, it's an amazing that these people over at the at CSIS, this think tank, were able to sniff this out, given that if you go back to polls as early as 2010 or prior, you know, you already have quite an undermining of the justice system, because nearly 45% of people in 2010, Pew Research found, too many people are in prison. That's, you know, that very far predates this hysteria that has seized our government for the last 2 to 3 years and made it nearly impossible to have any politically mature discussions about significant issues.
John, these people are also raising money for themselves. You know, it's like the military-industrial complex, then there's the national surveillance state or anti-terror complex. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All of these became fundraising things for former government officials like Suzanne Spaulding, formerly in the Obama Homeland Security Department. Here's what she wrote. Having long realized that the most effective disinformation is based on a kernel of truth, Moscow latches on to legitimate criticisms of the justice system. Shows like America's Lawyer and the, quote, criminal injustice segment of Sputnik's Loud and Clear often weave genuine concerns and viable grievances in with misleading narratives. Important causes are hijacked, making Kremlin-linked outlets appear to be the champions of justice reform in the United States, while in reality, their program is designed to exacerbate grievances and weaken our institutions. Like which ones? Like the prison industrial complex?
Right, exactly.
Anyway, Paul, when you heard this, that you every week, along with Kevin Gostala and John Kiriakou and myself, are undermining America's confidence in their own systems, because while it has a kernel of truth, what you've talked about has a kernel of truth, it feeds into a misleading narrative. What is the misleading narrative?
You know, actually, I think the misleading narrative is that we're not apologists for the police state. And I I think for me, though, unfortunately, this is nothing new. I started publishing prison legal news for my cell in a maximum security prison in Washington State in 1990. And for me, one of the big impetuses that I had to start publishing it was I was so disappointed in the corporate media and their coverage of criminal justice issues. The fact that they did not cover issues, they did not give any voice to prisoners or our families who are the people most affected by it. And the stunning lack of objectivity was one of the things that to this day always really annoys me, because government officials are taken at their word even when they're telling bald-faced lies. Reporters routinely suspend disbelief when it's like, well, a government official said it, so it must be true. And in 28 years of publishing prison legal news, we've never had to retract a story, unlike, say, the New York Times and other corporate media outlets. And, and more importantly, I think in 28 years of publishing, literally thousands and thousands of articles about abuses and corruption and misconduct in our nation's prisons and jails, no one has ever said that anything we publish isn't true. And I think that gets down to the whole thing. It's not so much that it can't be dismissed as lies, but rather it gets dismissed as, it's biased. But no one is claiming that it isn't true. And, we're routinely censored by prison and jail officials all over the country. And when I heard this yesterday, it recalled a couple years ago, back in 2010, when prison legal news was banned from the Virginia prison system. And the purported reason they gave was that we cast law enforcement in a negative light. And that was their direct quote. And I called up the head of their publications review committee at the time, because we never had problems with the Virginia DOC. And I asked them, what's the problem here? We haven't had any problems in the previous 20 years reaching Virginia prisoners. And he's like, well, I just took over, and I think your coverage of law enforcement officials is really negative. And I said, well, is there anything in particular? He said, yeah, your latest issue had an article detailing a settlement by the state of Virginia with 12 women prisoners that claimed they were sexually assaulted by guards at the women's prison. And I'm like, okay, so do you claim that the settlement didn't happen? No, it happened. Okay, so are you claiming that the women weren't sexually assaulted? And, he kind of hedged on that, but like a bunch of the guards were convicted of raping the women prisoners. And I said, so the thing here isn't that, you're not saying none of it's true. You just don't want people to know that your guards are routinely raping the women prisoners in your custody. And anyways, that was the end of that conversation. We filed suit. The case is going underway. And literally in the middle of the lawsuit, and they kept censoring every issue of prison legal news after that, saying we cast law enforcement in a negative light. And then as we're getting one point during the case, four Virginia prison employees that were on their canine unit were arrested on charges of bestiality and obscenity for having sex with their dogs in the canine unit and videotaping it. And of course, we published it in Prison Legal News, which was picked up in the mainstream media throughout the state. And it's kind of like, okay, this is the type of thing that, you can't make it up. And this is stuff they're actually doing. And not surprisingly, they don't want the world to know about it. But if they didn't kill people, if they didn't rape people, if they didn't have sex with animals and videotape it, we wouldn't have any news to report on. And I think rather than going to the root causes and ending the abuse, ending the misconduct, ending the rapes, they just want to shut down the messenger and silence us for telling people about it.
That's the voice of Paul Wright. We're talking to Paul Wright and Kevin Gostella about the fact that there is a new effort by the Center for Strategic and International Studies and former officials in the Department of Homeland Security to target our show, Loud and Clear, and particularly our segment that's hosted every Thursday by us and has Paul Wright and Kevin Gostella as the guest, where we examine the big issues of the criminal injustice system. We're being targeted because they're asserting that we are agents of the Kremlin carrying out the Kremlin's efforts to discredit institutions in America. And while there may be a kernel of truth, it's feeding into a misleading narrative. Now, John, just to help our audience understand what's going on, I want to read a little bit from the Washington Post. It's important to parse the words and to really see what this phenomena actually means and where it's going and to what end and to what purpose. And then we'll come back to Kevin. Russia's digital campaign, this is from last week's Washington Post, Russia's digital campaign to influence the 2016 presidential race in favor of President Trump put election security in the national spotlight, resulted in congressional investigations, and prompted lawmakers on Capitol Hill to set aside federal funding. Remember those words, federal funding, for states to strengthen their election systems. By contrast, Russia's apparent attempts to use similar tactics of spreading propaganda and disinformation on social media platforms to corrode the legitimacy of the U.S. judicial system have drawn much less scrutiny from policymakers, and I would add here for emphasis, and thus less federal funding, because that's where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
The band of experts doing research for the Center for Strategic and International Studies is tracking how Russian operatives tend to exploit sensitive issues such as immigration and race in posts designed to drum up a backlash to the justice system. Suzanne Spalding, a former undersecretary at the Department of Homeland Security in the Obama administration, who oversaw cybersecurity and critical infrastructure protection, and Harvey Ryshikov, a visiting professor of law at Temple University Beasley School of Law, are also part of the think tank's Defending Democratic Institutions project. Spalding, now a senior advisor to CSIS, says she plans to brief lawmakers on the research this month. The threat to the justice system, Spalding warns, could spread beyond influence campaigns and into actual hacking. She's going to Congress. She's going to testify against our show, against Criminal Injustice Segment, because they want federal funding.
And let me add something to that. And I want our listeners to really think about this. Until recently, I was married to someone who worked for a major defense contractor, and a part of her job was to go to organizations, including CSIS, right, to give them checks for $100,000, $250,000 to fund these so-called studies. Okay, Northrop Grumman was not the only firm that does that. General Dynamics does it, Boeing does it, all the big defense players do it. So studies just like this one that criticize this show and that criticize our criminal injustice segment are funded by the defense contractors, by the military industrial complex, congressional complex, whatever you want to call it, the deep state, whatever. This is not just a couple of innocent professors who decided that we were a danger to democracy. This is the defense contractors doing this. They're the ones that have paid for it.
Good point. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, there's a lot of money in this, and I'm glad that we're getting to this, because while this is kind of outside of our regular discussion of criminal justice issues, it's important to understand right now, because for the people at CSIS who are doing research and might listen to this segment, you know, hello, I hope you're learning something about our criminal justice system. But the office that CSIS has was actually funded with $1 million from the United Arab Emirates. It's a Gulf monarchy. They receive money from Gulf monarchies. These are governments that run very repressive regimes. They stamp down on freedom of expression. They engage in arbitrary detention. They engage in the kinds of criminal justice practices we would criticize our own government for engaging in. And they do it even to a worse extent. And additionally, you know, they, like you said, they receive quite a lot of defense contractor money. They receive cybersecurity contractor money. You know, Northrop Grumman's a big donor. Actually, they get $500,000 or more from Northrop Grumman. They, by the way, are involved in these kinds of things where they claim to be studying, but they're really advancing a certain agenda. You know, in particular, they not only are hyping these disinformation campaigns that are very hard to detect, if not entirely non-existent. But, you know, like Lockheed Martin and Huntington Ingalls Industries are two corporations that they fronted for by hyping this idea that there's like this gap between the U.S. and Russia when it comes to the Arctic. And that's because they want to help them get more contracts from the federal government for icebreaker ships in the North, in the Arctic Circle. And so this is what they do. I think there's a key part of this thing in the Washington Post, it's alluded to, but then specifically in the Lawfare piece that ran, they talk about these alleged hack and leak operations that might be ongoing. And out of nowhere, Suzanne makes up this whole thing about how the voting systems or not the voting systems, but how the court systems are going to be hacked into, and how they might pull out draft decisions and try to leak them prematurely and on all this without any evidence whatsoever. But that doesn't matter, because that's not the point. The point isn't to have any evidence of this. The point is to make us think that it's a possibility, so then cyber defense or cybersecurity contractors can swoop in and make a bunch of money. And I say to Suzanne Spaulding and others at CSIS that that's what you all are doing, but we here at Loud and Clear are not doing anything like that. We are not deceitful in any shape or form like that. I am not on any gravy train whatsoever.
Yeah, that's Kevin Gustala. We're joined by Kevin and Paul Wright talking about the attack against our show, Loud and Clear, and specifically the segment that Kevin and Paul join us on every Thursday called Criminal Injustice. Yeah, you're right. United Arab Emirates, South Korea, Turkey, Taiwan, a lot of government donors, a lot of corporate donors as well. Paul Wright, we want to go back to you. It seems to me that if we want to try to connect the dots here, you were talking, John, about the military-industrial complex or the surveillance state. They're getting lots of government money. It's a kind of a form of government welfare. They have to have a threat. The threat now is Russia. It also dovetails with the realignment of a U.S. military and foreign policy, the national security strategy, that is telling the American people, guess what? We must get ready for, prepare for, and fund in preparation for major power conflict. That would be with Russia and China. So it would seem to me that as that program goes forward, where the military-industrial complex is making lots of money by having a major enemy, partly when you explain to the American people, hey, you're not going to have as much money for schools and housing and other things that you actually need. It's for a good reason. And the good reason is it's preparing the country against this arch enemy, this evil force that's trying to undermine our country. You can't make the argument that Russia is going to invade the United States. So what are they doing? They're saying, well, Russia is kind of like a covert operation to bring us down. And somehow any group like ours that tells the truth about any institution that's so awful, like the U.S. criminal injustice system, that we're part and parcel of this effort. And then they're going to be making lots of money. Again, it's taxpayers' money. Go ahead, Paul.
No, I was going to say is that, you know, I think one of the things that we've seen, I think the overall discrediting, I think, goes back, I've been doing this for a while now, and I think back to the Rodney King beating, is that for the first time, the American public, with the advent of video cameras, which were still kind of new back then, people saw Rodney King being brutally beaten by a gang of policemen, and who were later acquitted and led to rioting and uprisings. And, you know, since then, I mean, we see the steady stream of police killings with the advent of cell phones in particular and social media. We see a daily stream of abuse by police forces, thanks to cell phones in prisons, which are banned. But, you know, we can see what's going on in prisons in a way that was never possible before. And I think this is almost, it reminds me of, this is almost like, you know, the Richard Pryor's line, is you've got the police state telling us, you know, don't believe your lying eyes, believe what us and our media shills are telling you. And instead, and, you know, and it's interesting because when they talk about this notion of somehow of discrediting, you know, American institutions, it makes me think about, you know, I'm thinking about, okay, I'm in daily contact every day with prisoners, with their family members, with people that have been victimized by the police state. And I'm just trying to think about, you know, like how much legitimacy do these institutions have with poor people? And, you know, and that's part of what makes me wonder, like, you know, what universe are these people in, where I think that the daily, you know, people in communities where every day they witness police abuses, every day you see government officials killing and raping and, you know, taking people's property and doing so with impunity. That's what I think erodes confidence in democratic institutions.
Indeed. You know what, Paul and Kevin, let's make this point too. You guys are telling the truth on criminal injustice every week. And the people in the communities, the targeted, affected communities, they know it's the truth. If any people in the Washington, D.C. area, working class communities heard our segment, they would say, yeah, that's right. That conforms to my own experience. None of that is actually untrue. Why is there no show like Criminal Injustice on MSNBC or CNN or CBS Radio? Like, guess what? I want to make an open call. If anybody, any of the capitalist-owned, corporate-owned mainstream media want to take our show, Criminal Injustice, where we interview Kevin Gostala and Paul Wright, we'd be glad to air it on those platforms. But guess what? They won't. They won't do it.
I was going to say the same thing before Paul responds. I am perfectly happy to go and talk about these issues on MSNBC or CNN or Fox or any other mainstream outlet, but I've never been invited. And I know, Brian, that you've never been invited either.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is the mainstream media is purged of these kind of stories. Maybe that's a kind of meddling in people's democracy. Again, CSIS, Kevin, we'll go back to you. The biggest donor, Bank of America. Second biggest donor, Chevron. Third biggest, Northrop Grumman. A fifth biggest, the Boeing Company. Sixth biggest, ExxonMobil Corporation. Then you have Lockheed Martin. Gosh, undermining the credibility of the institutions. This is just a big fraudulent hoax to raise money, our money, taxpayers' money. Instead of using money for this or building prisons, maybe people could like provide decent education for the children of America. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, it's dangerous too, though, because we've followed the ways in which Facebook, Twitter, and some of these other platforms have begun to remove voices simply because of guilt by association. So you do have to raise the specter, not because we think that's actually where it's going to go, but just because, again, I think it has to be part of our minds as we discuss this. Are the people at CSIS going to recommend to Congress that they pressure these Silicon Valley companies to remove Loud and Clear's account from the Twitter or Facebook, not have any access? Are they going to go to me, who relies on sharing my work, which is well-researched and involves well-documented sources and everything? And am I going to be targeted because I'm associated with this show and because you've made up this conspiracy out of whole cloth to suit your donors? How far does it go? How far does this affect the people who are trying to do meaningful work on criminal justice issues that are linked into this segment?
Yeah, we have 1 minute left. That's an excellent point. And also, Paul Wright, every time Martin Luther King or the Civil Rights Movement or any other social justice movements during the Cold War did anything, the same American politicians would say, spreading divisive issues, spreading talk about racism or fighting racism.
Yeah.
That's a Russian, that's a communist plot. It's always outside agitators, as if we need outside agitators in order to expose real injustice in America. 40 seconds left, you get the last word.
You know, routinely we hear this all the time when we go to communities where prison legal news is being banned, where publications are being banned from prisons and jails, and we get accused of being the outside agitators. But no, I say American people want justice, and they know they're not getting it.
We're going to leave it right there. That was Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He is also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. He was joined also by Kevin Gostala. Kevin is a writer for Shadowproof.com and the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. You can hear Paul and Kevin every Thursday on Loud and Clear in a segment called Criminal Injustice, where we look at the most egregious conduct of the police, the courts, prosecutors, and how civil rights and legal rights are denied to so many people in this country. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa. This is a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, Brian and John, always good to be back.
John and Chris, let's start with this story. It's on the front page of the New York Times today, on the front page of their website. It looks eerie because it is eerie. The headline is, "Your app knows where you were last night and they're not keeping it secret. Chris, what is this?
Well, and then they've got a subtitle sort of that says, "And it's for sale." It's not just where you were last night. It's where you were all day, where you were all weekend. So what this is about is app manufacturers, app companies use third-party advertising companies, and they often embed these the code from these third-party advertisers in their apps just to, you know, to show you ads. For example, if you're, you know, playing a free game or something like that, right? They got to they want to make money somehow, so they're going to embed this, you know, tracking code and these advertising companies' code into their apps to show you ads, and they get a little, you know, a little bit of money back when you view it, or even when you, you know, tap the ad and go look at what it is. These advertising companies, though, what they're doing is they're actually tracking your location almost in real time, most of the time, to see where you are. The problem with this is, right, is they can now create patterns. So they can track based on a unique identifier from your phone or in that app, you know, whoever you're signed in as in that app, who you are, and where you go on a regular basis. So there's you know, some examples in this New York Times article, right, about a teacher who goes, you know, to a middle school 14 miles away from home, and or then she goes to a Weight Watchers. There's somebody who goes to a Planned Parenthood clinic, and advertisers can find out, and they say it's in aggregate, which means there's no, you know, identifiable way to find out. But if you have enough of this data, it actually is possible to identify an individual based on the unique tracking codes and other signals that are used.
Well, actually, let me interrupt you on that too. And the Times points out that in many cases, like 46-year-old math teacher Lisa Magrin, she makes a 14-mile trip every day, leaving her house in upstate New York at 7 a.m. and going to middle school 14 miles away. She stays until late afternoon each school day. It says here only one person makes that trip, and that's Lisa Magrin, 46-year-old math teacher. Her smartphone goes with her. It reports back on her movements every 2 seconds. And so the New York Times, it took them all of a minute to figure out who this person was. And if they can do it to her, they can do it to you and to me and to any other American.
Absolutely. They can do it to anyone. And this is actually not the first time that these revelations have come out. There was actually a fitness tracking company called Strava. This happened earlier this year, which published maps of where its users were around the world.
Oh, boy.
And it caused an uproar because a lot of these, or in some of these, you could zoom in on military bases in Africa or Afghanistan, for example, and see the routes that soldiers were taking for their daily run. So this is not unique. This is something that has happens a lot. I'm glad to see this New York Times article. Here's the thing. This is, you know, these apps aren't specific like tracking apps, right? These are games. This is Facebook. This is, you know, other just general apps you could install on your phone. Your weather app could be one of them. Location targeted advertising is like a $21 billion a year industry at this point. And we're not aware that when we're playing a game, we're being tracked by at least one, maybe many of these advertising and location services companies. We're just trying to play a game because we're, you know, on the bus or in the checkout line at the supermarket and it's really long because they don't have enough people working the registers. We're not aware that this is what's happening. No one reads the terms of service. Let's be real about that. And frankly, the terms of service for the apps, for those of us who do read them occasionally, they're never clear about who the partners are, what private company is getting your data, and where and what it's being used for.
You know, the interesting thing too, Brian, is, as Chris just alluded to a second ago, it shouldn't be up to the New York Times to tell us that this is happening. Every app that we download, or the phone manufacturer, or more, I guess, appropriately, the provider ought to be telling us that this is happening. And they don't.
No, they don't. I mean, here, this is not a new thing.
No.
Right? It's not new, but it's new. It's kind of new to us. I mean, we hear stories. We know, hey, they're tracking us constantly. Yep. And you know, again, John, from a legal point of view, people should know you have the presumption of privacy. So if you say, for instance, on your phone, oh, I know the FBI is listening to me anyway because I'm a whatever, anti-war activist or environmental activist, you've actually given up your presumption of privacy.
Oh, good point.
You can't claim it. So people shouldn't actually joke around and say, oh, I know so-and-so is listening or any of this kind of thing. But the fact of the matter is, that's my technology tip for the day, by the way.
Yeah, that's important, actually.
But the fact of the matter is, you have a corporate structure, You have a banking structure. You have a government surveillance structure. We've all made their jobs very, very, very easy because we have smartphones and we use apps. So what conceivable way can people choose to do something that actually protects their privacy and their presumption of privacy? Go ahead, Chris. It's a tough question.
It is a tough question. One option would be to give up your cell phone, but I don't think most people or almost anyone is going to be, you know, willing to do that. We rely on these devices to keep us in contact with each other and then the world around us. One thing you can do, and I guess this is kind of an early tech tip, would be on both iPhones and Android phones. There are settings in your privacy settings where you can say that you only let apps use your location services when the app is open.
Yes.
When you've recently used it, or never at all. So you don't need to let a game use your location services. Now, in a case of an app, like if you're using a ride-sharing app, Uber or Lyft, you kind of need that, right? So you can say, only when I'm using the app can you get my location. Otherwise, you have no idea actually when in the background, when you're not even using the app, for a certain amount of time, the app could actually still be tracking you.
Yeah, besides the fact that it's draining your battery.
What if your phone is off? Still tracking?
If your phone is entirely off, then no, you're not being tracked at that point. The apps can't run, they can't get off, you know, go off the network or all of that. So if your phone's entirely off, you're in pretty good shape.
So maybe that's the answer. Just don't give up your phone. Just never turn it on.
We got to remember, too, that, you know, there are multiple layers of this location-based tracking, right? The second you turn your phone on, you could have no apps installed. Your cell phone company can still track you. They have to know kind of where you are in order to route that, you know, your phone call or your text message from, you know, from wherever it's coming from through their towers to the closest tower to you so you have good signal. So even if you don't have any apps installed, you haven't used any apps, you can still be tracked by the cell phone company. And there has been some indication that the companies are certainly working with law enforcement, but also maybe working with private companies. We don't know for sure at this point. The research is still ongoing, but that's one layer. And then these apps, these private companies that no one has ever heard of that are partnering with app manufacturers are a completely separate layer of this.
I'm looking again at the Times graphic. We don't recommend people going to this or that media outlet unless it's for a good cause, which I would say the New York Times is not. It's a business. But
this photo's shocking.
People should look at this graphic. Again, the article is about your app knows where you were last night and they're not keeping it secret. So here's the app. It's kind of interactive. Lisa McGrin is the only person who travels regularly from her home to the school where she works. We talked about her earlier. Her location was recorded more than 800 times there, often in her classroom. Now, if you scroll down, you can then see how Lisa got to work. Mm-hmm. And it's a long sort of yellow line through the woods.
Yeah, it plots it out, like with Google Earth.
It plots it out. Then the next graph is her ex-boyfriend's, where he hikes and when he goes to the airport. It's amazing. I mean, and of course, Chris, with metadata, meaning people don't know that I have to be, what I actually said to John Kiriakou, for instance, on the phone. But if people who have my metadata can see, I talk frequently to John Kiriakou.
Yep.
I talk frequently to Walter Smolarek and Nicole Roussel, a couple other people, my kids. And you can more or less make out exactly what I've been doing for the last years,
yeah,
in fact.
It's true.
I mean, I've seen with some technology people showing me, well, exactly how the metadata works. And you can really see exactly how someone is spending their time and with whom.
You can really.
And then you can know, like, what they're doing.
Oh, yeah. You could put together an entire story about somebody's life just with metadata. I mean, are you going to an abortion clinic? Are you meeting a secret boyfriend or girlfriend? Are you going to, you know, an oncologist? Or you can make an entire story for somebody without even having any of the direct information.
Again, I want to go over how it works commercially, because again, I think there's kind of a mystery about this thing. The companies that provide the apps are then selling the data. Is that what's actually happening? The article says in the Times, at least 75 companies receive anonymous precise location data from apps whose users enable location services to get local news and weather on or other information. according to a Times report. Again, John, what you were saying, the Times did this story. That's why we know about it. Several of those businesses claim to track up to 200 million mobile devices in the United States, about half of those in use last year. The database reviewed by the Times, a sample of information gathered in 2017 and held by just one company, reveals people's travels in startling detail, accurate to within a few yards, and in some cases updated more than 14,000 times a day.
Incredible.
In a 24-hour period.
That's every couple of seconds.
So again, Chris, how do they make their money doing this? What's the actual commodity exchange here?
Well, they're selling advertising, and they're selling advertising based on exactly not just where you are, but where you've been. They develop pattern analysis that says if you've been to, let's say, a Whole Foods, you might like to get advertisements about what the new deal at Whole Foods or a new store that's opening up that is trying to compete. If they see you're going to a specialist's office, a doctor, they could try to sell you some medication, which in and of itself is a ridiculous thing. They can track it. So it's not just about where you are at that moment. It's about developing a pattern of your behavior, comparing that to others' behavior and what they've purchased or what they've expressed interest in, and then using this a whole bunch of statistical analysis in order to say, okay, what is this person most likely to buy or be interested in? What kind of events do they go to? Are they going to like this band and this concert coming up? That's how they make money. And they do this in milliseconds. They do this analysis and they do this targeting in milliseconds. It often seems like the ads we get were, you know, pre-set up for us, but actually the ad exchanges decide very, very quickly, in under a second, what ad they're going to show to you specifically based on all of this data they have about you.
Chris Garaffa is our guest. We talk to Chris every Monday in this segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. Let's go to another privacy surveillance state issue. This one has to do with Homeland Security and their own interaction with our computers. Go ahead.
Right. So Homeland Security, so this is an article from The Intercept. Homeland Security is letting computers predict who might be a terrorist on your plane. Now, I really think they buried the lead in this story, too. You know, they talk about having, you know, watch lists and obscure rules about who gets on a plane and who gets extra scrutiny. But here's the thing. A private company called Data Robot, which is based in Virginia, which, as we know, is home to much of the, you know, kind of industrial, the, you know, information industrial complex, as well as the military industrial complex, is taking this software and giving it to foreign airports. So this is an international situation. Free software from this company that they've partnered with to develop it. Now, here's the thing. I'm going to read a couple quotes. They're going to develop, quote, predictive models to enhance identification of high-risk passengers. And they say they're going to use that to, quote, make real-time predictions. And just like the advertising we were just talking about, that's going to be in less than a second. Here's the thing, though, too. The Data Robot, right, their clients include the CIA, Monsanto, and other giant companies and government agencies. And we have no way of knowing specifically what information this software is using. We don't know what the algorithm is. We don't know how it makes a decision as to who is a potential terrorist or a threat for a plane. Effectively, the government has already had these watch lists and these obscure and private rules that, you know, people have even tried to do FOIA requests for, and have had very limited success getting that. But now there is a private company that is not just in U.S. airports, but in international airports, going to be deciding who gets on a plane to the U.S. and who doesn't, with no ramifications if they make a mistake, almost no way to find out why you were on this list, why you were refused access to a flight.
You know, there's kind of a famous story, famous here in Washington, that just before his death, Ted Kennedy was twice refused permission to get on a plane to Boston because there was apparently a former IRA terrorist named Ted Kennedy. And so they had to make sure that Senator Ted Kennedy, who everybody in the world would recognize, was not the IRA terrorist Ted Kennedy. Well, that was a human being that made that stupid decision. Imagine now with a computer or a robot making this decision.
Yeah. You know, the Council of American Islamic Relations, CARE, which is the largest Islamic or Muslim civil rights group in America. They filed a lawsuit because there's so many people on the no-fly watch who are not in any way associated with any terrorist organization, but they have the same name, or they have the same name and came from the same town. Some of the people of the plaintiffs, Chris, who were on that lawsuit, one was a three-year-old girl. She had been put on the no-fly watch when she was like 6 months old.
Right. And they wouldn't tell the parents why. And they also wouldn't tell the parents how to get the little girl off the watch list.
Yeah, she's still on because she's a plaintiff in the lawsuit. It's crazy. Chris, let's go on. What's the next story? Australia.
Yes, we're going down under. We're going to Australia. They just passed a new law in Australia that effectively says that the government, via a warrant process, can force a company to provide a way to get at encrypted communications. So encrypted communications are when you send somebody a message, the content of that message is set up in such a way that only you, the sender, and the person you intended to see it can open it. And that's done via basically it's math. You know, privacy activists always say encryption is math. You can't ban math, right? You can try. They're certainly trying. But now Australia is going to impose fines, $10 million Australian dollars for companies that don't comply with these warrants, and $50,000 Australian dollar fines for individuals who don't comply with these warrants. Now, that could be the developer, it could be a manager, that could be anyone at the company. $50,000 Australian dollar fine for not providing a backdoor, a way to get at these, what should be encrypted, secret, private messages between individuals. The reason this, the other reason this is so important, right, is Australia, there are something like 70-something amendments that haven't been considered for this law. The law was just passed as it was proposed, and they're going to possibly consider these amendments later. And the amendments, some of them are very good in talking about limiting this power and getting rid of some of these fines. But the law has been passed. It's going to go into effect. And this is also an international issue because Australia is part of what's called Five Eyes. Five Eyes is an alliance. It's an international alliance with New Zealand, the US, the UK, Canada, and Australia. They share signal intelligence data. They share information that they get through watching network traffic, from decrypting messages, and all of that. There's a war on encryption, effectively, in the Five Eyes countries. In the UK, Theresa May has also been pushing for a similar law. We haven't yet seen anything like this at that scale in the US, but I think we have reason to believe that it's going to be coming. It's effectively a war on encryption, which is going to be a war on math, effectively.
Let's go on, Chris. Time is going fast, and we've covered a lot of stories. We have quite a number more. I want to go to having lived in New York for 30 years, this one can't be good. New York City Police Department with its own drone air force.
That sounds like a good idea.
It's happening.
The New York City Police Department, I believe, is actually one of the largest private army, you know, effectively a large private army, right?
It's 40. I mean, you know, that's the thing. I want to just make mention of this. The thing about Paris this last weekend with the yellow vest movement, you know, those big headlines, the police, they're going to deploy 8,000 police to Paris for the protests. New York City Police Department is 45,000 people. 45,000. They're deployed every day in New York City. And if you go to a demo, go to a protest, they're really deployed.
Yeah, half the demonstrators are probably undercover New York City policemen.
No, that's too depressing. I know there's 50% would be really depressing for those of us who organize demonstrations. Anyway, why the drone air force for the NYPD?
Well, the NYPD says that they're going to use these drones, and they're doing a pilot program of starting at 14 and their drones, and they're going to train about 30 officers to use them. They're saying that they're going to use them for search and rescue, for crime scenes.
Oh, it's for good things. It's to save people.
But also to monitor large events. And that's exactly right, Brian. They could be monitoring concerts. They could be monitoring street festivals. They could certainly be monitoring protests. You know, Brian. Brian, you've lived in New York. You have been to Harlem. You've seen, particularly in Harlem, they have these large mobile command towers, right, that they use to surveil neighborhoods, that they use to surveil. I remember seeing many of them on 125th Street, especially before the gentrification. This is just another, you know, this is like taking that and doing it at a citywide scale. These drones are going to be able to surveil anyone who is under the camera. They say that they're not going to use that information for warrantless, you know, spying, but it's practically impossible to do that.
Wait a second. It is warrantless spying.
It is.
I mean, the warrant has to have specificity. It has to say there's probable cause.
That's right.
That an individual has committed a crime or is in the process of committing a crime or planning a crime. There has to be a warrant from a court that says the police and government power has the right to spy, to search and seize you. In other words, to search. That's what surveillance is. But it has to be with probable cause. If you have how many drones? 14 NYPD unmanned drones flying around the city. The whole thing is warrantless surveillance. I'm looking at the cop chief of department, Terrence Monahan, said, let me be clear, NYPD drones will not be used for warrantless surveillance. Well, that's exactly what they're used for. I mean, that's what they're used for.
That's exactly it. Now, these could have good uses, right? They could be used for crisis situations, storms, but they are going to be for warrantless surveillance. They're going to be to gather information to see who's at a protest, who's at an event, where people are going, all of that. When you combine this with facial recognition technologies and other human tracking technologies, essentially, that are coming out, like Amazon's recognition that we know the NYPD has been interested in, there is really no limit on what they could do with all of this information on us. It's a very scary thought.
Chris, I don't know if you know, I think you were you at the September 15th, 2007 demonstration against the surge in Iraq?
I absolutely was there, yes.
Yeah, I thought you were there. And John, I mentioned to you that we had these dragonflies. I was one of the principal organizers of the demonstration,
right,
against, and it was a big demo, about 100,000 people. There were these dragonflies that were sort of flying around those of us who were the organizers when we were huddled together planning, we're going to do this or we're going to go this way. Ultimately, a couple hundred people got arrested that day, including myself, down at the Capitol building. But people said, those aren't dragonflies. Those look like little machines. And I was like, no, these are movement people who are getting too paranoid. And then the Washington Post called and said, did you see some dragonflies that look like little machines? And I said, I didn't see them, but people told me about them, that they were flying overhead. And I said, but I thought it's paranoia. And the reporter said, I wouldn't go there yet about paranoia. And they actually did a front page story. I think it was a front page story in the Post about the fact that this may have been an experimental use of drone technology to spy on a peaceful demonstration that, you know, people coming together redressing grievances. But it makes perfect sense. If the NYPD has a drone air force now, of course they're going to use that against political activists and against people gathered together to redress grievances, to exercise free speech rights. I mean, people should understand this for what it is. We're kind of joking about it, but it's actually no joking matter.
No, this is an assault on our civil liberties.
It really is. Chris, we have just under 5 minutes. Let's go to the next issue, corporate surveillance.
Well, let's talk about Facebook. There was a huge data drop last week by a member of parliament in the UK. These were documents that were obtained by the UK police, and they were released by Damian Collins. It's from a lawsuit, a company called 643 against Facebook. This is a 250 pages of documents about from this lawsuit, where they basically show that Facebook is doing what we know it's doing, but it's talking about how they justify it. We should say 643, this company, kind of disgusting. One of their apps let people find photos of their friends and their friends' friends in bikinis. So kind of disgusting there, right? But the way that worked was that this app had to have access to your friends and to their friends. Facebook, a few years ago, because of all the pressure, started turning off some of this access, except it started to whitelist certain companies who said that their businesses would fail if Facebook turned off this access. So general app developers couldn't use this, but Facebook would make deals with some companies and some app developers to say that they can use this. They would effectively be whitelisted to get all friends. So 643 was trying to get this, a company called Hot or Not, a dating app called Badoo. Netflix is another one of these. And there are just a treasure trove of emails from Mark Zuckerberg and other high-level Facebook executives. Zuckerberg in these frequently refers to growth being the most important thing. What is growth in terms of Facebook? Growth is more users. Growth is those users generating more data. So they were trying to increase their engagement rates. How many times you tap, how many times you scroll, all the stories you look at. One of the things that is getting and should get the most attention here is that a few years ago, Facebook wanted to get access to, and they've had this access, to people's contacts, text messages, and phone logs on their phones. Now, Android phones particularly started locking this down around the same time that these emails were going around. The permissions that Facebook wanted would generally have required the user to explicitly give permission to Facebook. The user would have seen Facebook is requesting access to your phone logs, your text messages, and your contacts. Facebook actually says, this would be bad PR for us. Let's find a way to make the permission request less visible. And they did find a way by releasing effectively a giant new version of the app, and they had a technical workaround for this. They knew it would be bad PR to ask for your text message logs and your phone logs and your contacts, and they went and found just a way around it effectively.
Chris Garafa, we have so little time left, not enough time for your tech tip, but actually we must. We can't end this show without your tech tip. 40 seconds left.
Okay, it's the holiday shopping season, and if you have been delaying doing your shopping like me, you're probably doing some stuff online, right? And if you're ordering through, you know, a big company like Amazon, your credit card is probably okay. But if you're finding special gifts for special people in your life on a website that you're not so sure about the credibility of, you can actually avoid putting your credit card number in. Go to your credit card company's website and look for what's called a virtual card number. That's going to be a one-time use number that's still attached to your account. But if a hacker happens to intercept it or get it, or a data leaks from that company you're buying something from, it can't ever be used again. So if you're buying stuff online, go get a virtual credit card number. You can get this from practically all of the major credit card companies just by signing into your account.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. That was Chris Garafa. We talk to Chris every Monday in this segment called Technology Rules, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.